We're back. We're back with another episode of the podcast, and we're back. Hey, what's up? Have you seen the latest YouTube exclusive content yet? Okay, because this is the podcast. This is fun. This is a little live, off-the-cuff, improvised thing that I do. But the YouTube exclusive content, that's more structured, that's edited, that's got jokes, that's got gags, that's fun and entertaining in a whole different way. I know a lot of my TikTok audience isn't aware of it. We got over 100 people here on TikTok. I make YouTube exclusive content now, video essay style, long form, horizontally formatted videos, and I really am proud of them. I really am proud of them. I uploaded my most recent episode yesterday. It was called The Entire Plot of Argylle, : the worst movie ever made, because Argylle might be the worst movie ever made. I haven't seen Madame Web, but I don't think it's beyond Hollywood in this day and age to release maybe the two worst movies ever made back-to-back, like in like almost back-to-back weekends. Just from seeing the very, very little I have seen of Madame Web and, you know, like the few reviews that I've looked at, it does look like it is awful. I'm going to go out on a limb and say Argylle's worse, mostly because Argylle is trying so hard to be good. Argylle's trying so hard to convince people that it's smart, to the point where like it did convince like 70% of the audience members that went to see it, that it was good. There's so many plot twists in Argylle that it succeeds at making the audience feel like, if I just pretend like I'm following this, then that will mean I'm smart because I'm following. And it's like, no. Whereas I think a movie like Madame Web is fully just acknowledging like, hey, this isn't it. Like, we know this. This movie was scheduled and we had to release something. And they hired this like writing team that are the guys that you go to when you're like, hey, we've already cast this movie. We already have the actors in it. We just need you to write a screenplay and we need it done by this date. And we need it to feature these things. And we need it to have this product placement. And we need it to say these lines. And they're like, okay, we'll do it. And they're just sort of like guns for hire writers who aren't actually trying to write a good screenplay, who are just like, they get the work in on time and they follow all the producer's notes. And I don't think that Madame Web was like trying to trick anyone into thinking it was a better movie than it was. Like, I think everyone involved in making it was like, this is gonna be rough. We're gonna get it out there, but this is gonna be rough. Like, we all know, like, this is bad. It's sort of like a Morbius situation where like even Jared Leto was like, let's do Morbius. And then it was like, okay, yeah, that was bad. But Argylle was like Matthew Vaughn telling everyone years in advance, this movie's going to blow your mind. This is going to be the best movie I've ever made. This movie's going to redefine the spy thriller genre. This movie's going to the character of Agent Aubrey Argylle is going to take over where James Bond left off and become the new James Bond. So Argylle like really was trying to do something. And for that reason, I'm going to say Argylle's worse than Madame Web. Anyway, that's not the point of the podcast today, but that is the theme of my most recent YouTube exclusive video. It's an hour long. I break down the entire plot of Argylle in a very fun, entertaining, funny way. And I have I was going through all of my YouTube exclusive content yesterday and I was like, dude, I've been crushing. These videos are solid. I think it's the best kept secret on YouTube right now, personally. But anyway, I also do this. I do the podcast. So let's do the podcast. Let's do this now. The title of the episode today is The Moving Power of Reconciliation. Corny. So corny. I was really trying to figure out what a good title would be that doesn't sound so much like a LDS General Conference talk title, but that's the title of the episode. That's what I'm talking about, so I shouldn't shy away from it, but so corny. The Moving Power of Reconciliation. But that is what it is. That's what I wanted to talk about. So, yeah, you know, I was recently doing my drive back and forth from Salt Lake City to LA. I had to drive out to Salt Lake to get some dental work done, as I do from time to time, because the procedure I wanted to get done was going to cost like $4,500 in LA, and it only cost me like $500 in Salt Lake. Don't ask me why. I don't understand any of it. I never do. I just do what the people say, what the capitalists say, it costs this much. And I go, does it cost less somewhere else? And they say, it does. And I go, then I will go to the other place where it costs less. And that's what I do. And I don't look into it and I don't try to figure out why. I just go where I got to go to get the dental work done a little bit more affordably. But anyway, I was driving out and my parents told me to listen to this podcast that they had listened to, that they told me they were crying the whole way through and they found it so moving. It's a podcast from KSL Podcasts. You can find this on Spotify. If you look up KSL Podcasts, the letter. KSL Podcasts, so with an S at the end there, the letter. It's just called The Letter, but it's produced by KSL Podcasts, which is a Utah media company. It's a Salt Lake City-based media company, which is where I'm from. There are people asking in the chat if I'm from Salt Lake, if I'm XLDS. Yes, I am. Welcome to the show. And this show, I don't want to tell you everything, but I will tell you that there's going to be a few spoilers here. Okay. There's like 8 or 9 episodes of this show. And the only real spoiler I'm going to tell you is something that you find out at the end of the first episode. But I'll tell you just sort of the gist of what the story is of this show in general. And then I will still really encourage you to go give it a listen. But the first episode of the show starts off with this woman answering a phone call from someone named George. And you don't know who that is as an audience member. She just picks up the phone and goes, oh, hi, George. And she's talking to this guy named George on the phone. And she's like, oh, you know, things are going well here. How are things going for you? She's like, oh, yeah, great. And she's like, I went to your niece's wedding last weekend. She looked beautiful. It's this very pleasant conversation that this woman's having with this guy, George. And I'm listening and going, yeah, I'm sure this will they're going to let me know what this is about later on in the show. But then they go back and they tell us the story of who this woman is and what her life story is and the story of her family. And they tell you the story of how in 1996, I believe it was August 28th or August 22nd, 1996, her 18-year-old son was out on a date with a friend and a 19-year-old man just walked by with a gun and just shot them both several times. And wound up murdering her son and almost killing this young woman. And it was just this sort of random, senseless act of violence. You know, one of those things that just doesn't make any sense in the world that happens to people and they just, all you can really do is scratch your head and go, what is even the point of that? Because there was no clear motivation from the killer and he turned himself in, or he was picked up almost immediately within 24 hours and he confessed to the crime immediately. And when they asked him why he did it, he couldn't really give a straight answer. He said he was trying to commit suicide and he didn't have the guts to do it. And he'd always wondered what it would be like to shoot somebody. But it's like, yeah, so her son was just in the wrong place at the wrong time around the wrong person. And now he's not alive anymore. And this girl's life is altered forever. And they take you through this story of what happened to these two families, the family of the girl that survived and the family of the kid that died. And you know, you hear stories from them around the time that it was happening and how upset and, you know, just kind of steeped in understandable grief and confusion they are. And you hear them talking about how they can't conceive of the man who did it as being a human being. They can only conceive of him as being a monster, and how they want him to get the death penalty. But if they can't get the death penalty, they'll settle for life in prison. They just want to make sure that he has the worst possible life he can, because they have such deep, searing hatred for them. You hear them relaying experiences of how they never really knew what it felt like to hate. They never really knew what it felt like to truly feel despair and to feel, you know, true, like a passionate dislike for another person to the point of wanting that person to feel pain until this happened. And now they really could feel that like fiery hatred. And it's all very understandable. It's all stuff that you listen to and you don't, if you have an ounce of empathy in your body, you don't judge these people for describing their experience the way that they're describing it. It makes sense that they feel the way that they feel and that they are having the experience that they're having, that they have this disdain for this man. And that all sort of just leads up to the end of the first episode. And this is where I started breaking down crying in my car. it goes back to this phone call that she's having in the present. This was like in, they were recording this in like 2022 or 2021. And she's talking to this guy on the phone, this guy George that called her. And she says this thing, like, I'm listening to the show. And then I hear her say this line. She says, did you get outside this week? Were you able to get outside and exercise? And then she goes, that's good. I like it when you're able to get outside. And I'm going to start crying right now. As I talk about it, I realized in that moment who she was talking to on the phone, and I burst into tears in my car because I realized that she was talking to, she was talking to the man who killed her son. And I mean, I just got to say that nothing in this world moves me like reconciliation. And especially reconciliation that emerges against all odds. I am just so profoundly moved by people finding the strength within themselves to try to move through the trauma of being hurt deeply by another person in a way that is profoundly affecting. Severe abuse or, grand betrayal or, murder, something so intensely inhumane and violent. And like I said, I still encourage you highly to go listen to this show, but it's important to the context of this episode for me to sort of give you that little detail that that's what it's about, is this family, this couple, this mother and father who found their way to having a relationship with this man who murdered their son. And it didn't happen overnight. It took years and years and years for them to get to this place. But what happened to them before they were willing to approach the process of trying to not hate this man was they got to witness firsthand what hatred was doing to them and their experience, their human experience. And it was corroding them, and it was corrosive to everything in their life and all of their relationships, and it was corrosive to their ability to be themselves, to show up in life, to show up for their friends, to show up for the children that they had left. They still had three children still living. Their children grew up and started, giving them grandchildren. And it was like their ability to show up and be present as grandchildren and parents and friends was being corroded by the amount of hatred that they had for this one person who was spending the rest of his life in prison. Somebody asked in the chat, what is the name of the show? It's called The Letter, and you can find it from KSL Podcasts. And what's so fascinating about it is that they sort of decided on their own independently that they were going to begin the process of trying to forgive this man without really consulting him or approaching him or talking to him about it in any way. They just wanted for themselves to just move on from the resentment and the anger and the hatred because they needed it in their own lives. They needed to not hate this person anymore. They needed to be able to move forward and to start having an existence that wasn't just built around hating this guy. And shortly after they began that process, the guy sent them a letter from prison expressing his deep remorse and regret for his actions. Not asking them for forgiveness, not asking them for anything that he felt like he deserved from them, because he is very clear that doesn't feel like he deserves anything from them. Just letting them know in no unclear terms that he is aware of the harm that he has done completely and that he feels it on a daily basis and that he wants them to know that he knows how terrible of a thing he did and that he just feels terrible. And I don't think that he ever expected to hear back from them. And I think it's probably the biggest surprise of both of their lives, or all of their lives, that they now have this like really lovely relationship, and they talk regularly, and they say I love you to each other when they get off the phone, and it's just it's just like it's one of the most beautiful stories I've heard in a long time. We've had stories like this on this podcast before. Somebody just said, Austin, just dropping in to say hi, bud. Love your stuff. Keep doing what you do best. Thank you very much. Thanks for dropping in. We've had stories on this podcast before. There's an episode of this podcast called Shame with Christian Branscombe, who's a friend of mine who I met at a party one night. And this is a guy who spent 25 years of his life in prison for murder. And he was granted a commutation by the governor of California. And it was the first commutation for a life sentence due to murder one in the history of the state of California. And essentially what happened is Christian Branscombe just restructured his life in prison to become the kind of person who no longer belonged in prison, and that people who met him could recognize that he no longer belonged there, and that the prison system was no longer a place that he needed to be in order for others to be safe. And he was let out. And I think that the story of Christian Branscombe was probably more common than people realize, that there are probably far more incarcerated people who maybe at one point did need to be kept away from society in order for society to be safe from them, who are able to find their way to being people who are no longer unsafe and can be trusted and can be relied upon. I know that in the 5.5 years that I've – well, really 6 years. I've been sober for 5.5 years, but I've been going to AA for 6 years. I know in the 6 years that I've been in recovery rooms, I've just heard countless stories over and over and over again, hundreds of stories of people who have done really bad things and really harmed people and hurt people in bad ways, who have now been spending the last, you know, however many years of their life – working on undoing that harm and coming to terms with that harm, being accountable to that harm, and living their life in a way that functions as a living amends for the harm that they've done. And many of these people in recovery get to experience several times over, if they're lucky, sort of the miracle of reconciliation. You get to go through a process. AA is sort of famous for the amends process. It's our ninth step in our program of, you know, the 12 steps program, the process of doing an amends to the people that you have wronged. And this is sort of a famous thing. You know, there's an episode of Seinfeld about it where George is mad because he feels like a recovering alcoholic makes a an inadequate amends to him. he doesn't apologize for blaming George for stretching out the hole in the neck on his sweater. He just kind of says like, sorry, George, sorry I was rude to you. But George is like, well, you need to say sorry for yelling at me for stretching out the neck hole on your sweater. And he's like, but you did stretch out the neck hole on my sweater, and that I'm allowed to be mad about that. Anyway, great episode. But yeah, it's sort of a famous part of recovery is this amends process. And I've just been able to witness in my own life and in the lives of other people that I meet in this program over and over and over again, people who are able to go and talk to someone who they have done great harm to and say, I want to, you know, first of all, approaching them and saying, would you be open to talking about this? And the person says yes. And then saying, you sit them down and say, here are all the things, the ways that I'm aware of that I've harmed you in my life. And then offering them a chance to let you know how they felt when you did those things. And then offering them a chance to say, is there anything that I left off this list? Is there anything I'm missing here? So that's where what the Seinfeld episode actually gets wrong is, if he was doing his amends process correctly, he should have asked George, did I leave anything off the list? And then George could have said, I didn't like when you yelled at me for stretching out the neck hole on your sweater. And he could have said, you know what? You're right. That was out of pocket. George is Larry David, as we all know. And my personal opinion is that Larry David is right more often than he's wrong in Curb Your Enthusiasm. And often in Seinfeld too, where it's like, they make him out to be the asshole, but I'm like, no, he's not wrong necessarily. You know, he's not wrong to be upset that at a work meeting, the boss and the entire staff ganged up on him for eating too much shrimp. He's allowed to be upset about that. That's rude that the boss and everybody else bullied him. And he should be allowed a chance to go back and say jerk store. I believe that. Anyway, what are we talking about? Reconciliation. But no, you get this process, you get this opportunity to sit down with someone and say, you know, here's all the ways that I know I harmed you, and, you know, and then let them tell you the ways that you forgot that you harmed them, or that you weren't even aware that you harmed them. And then you get to ask them, what can I do to make up for this going forward? How can I make amends to you going forward? And it's such a, like, it's such a just stunningly beautiful process. I don't know if there's anything more powerful in the human experience than getting to do that. And when it act like, I mean, this story that I talked about in this podcast, this story of this man who murdered these people's son, he knows that he has no right to ask them to let him off the hook for what he's done, or to ask them for forgiveness or anything. And so he doesn't approach them that way. He just approaches them saying, I just want you to know that I know. I just want you to be aware that I'm aware of the harm that I've done. And it took him a while too. So I want to say something too, that like, none of this is easy. And it usually takes people years. It usually takes a really long time for people to find the strength and the courage to be open to a process of reconciliation. A lot of people prefer to live their lives in a state of active resentment or in a refusal to forgive. And in a lot of circumstances, it's totally understandable. Another aspect of that story, of that podcast, is these parents of this kid who died, they're now actively engaged in a process of trying to get the man who murdered their son out of prison. They're trying to, they feel like he's been in prison for 25 years, and they feel like he's been in there for long enough, and they know him well enough at this point to know that he's not the same person that killed their son, and they want him to be able to have another chance at life, the same way that my friend Christian Branscombe did. And you can hear more about that again on that episode called Shame, which is an episode of this podcast. And so these people are fighting for him to get out of prison, but the woman who survived the shooting all the way back in 1996 is fighting against them, and she doesn't want him to get out of prison. And a big part of her story is that they've tried to reach out to her and say, hey, would you be open to talking to him? Because we talk to him, and we actually really, really like him, and we have a really good relationship with him, and we think that you could really benefit from just seeing that he's not the person that attacked you that night, that he's a different person now, and he, like his time, his 25 years in prison have changed him, and he is aware of the harm that he's done. And she's not open to it. She's just very close. Her healing process has been to say, I am closed off to that person. I don't allow that person into my space, into my mind, into my heart. I don't want that person to have anything to do with me in my life. And I don't want to know that he's out of prison. I want to keep him where he is. And that's part of her healing process. And honestly, and I deliver all of this saying I'm not judging her for that. It's an understandable human reaction. And like, she's very much so allowed to feel that way and to have that response to hearing that there's an effort being made to get him out of prison. Her emotional response to that is valid, 100%. And I honor it, and I empathize with it, and I have compassion for it. All that being said, and I really want to make it clear that I'm not saying this from a point of judgment or anything like that, I'm not sure that it actually is the most healing approach. And I think it's evident in the story as you listen to it unfold that, like, to me, it's very clear that the healing that the parents of the boy who died, the healing that they've been able to experience through the reconciliation process is more complete and really feels like it's been more transformative than the healing process that the woman who survived has been going through, because she still deals greatly with a lot of fear and a lot of anxiety, debilitating anxiety. And again, all of this is so understandable. All of this is so, like, valid and allowed, and like, she gets to take the time that it takes her. But I'm not, I just am, when I look at it from like a, you know, a person interested in the human psyche and the human experience and interested in the therapeutic process and in the process of trying to recover from trauma, I really believe that a process of reconciliation has a much more strong restorative power and has much stronger restorative properties and transformative properties to really be able to say, oh, now I can really truly allow myself to move forward and put that part of my life away. And it no longer needs to be something that dictates how I move through the world and how I make decisions and how I approach the world and how I feel about the world around me. And all of this is like so much easier said than done. It's so easy to like listen as an outside observer and be able to see it from this objective place and not be in the middle of it emotionally. So that's why I really want to reiterate that I have a lot of empathy for the emotional reality of anybody who's trying to heal from trauma. There's another episode that I did sort of on this topic on this podcast with my friend Whit Hertford, and that episode is called Forgiveness. So there's two episodes that I would say work as good companion pieces to this episode, and that's Shame with Christian Branscombe and Forgiveness with Whit Hertford. And one of the things that Whit and I talked about in the Forgiveness episode is we had a lot of people in the chat saying things like, there are people in my life who have hurt me in a way that I just simply do not feel like they deserve my forgiveness, and I don't think it's appropriate for anyone to tell me that I have to forgive them. And again, I really want to make it clear that I think that is a valid viewpoint, and I understand that viewpoint, and I honor that emotional reality that a lot of people are living with, that like that person has done things to me that I do not believe are worthy of the gift of my forgiveness, are worthy of a desire for me to reconcile. Sometimes people have been hurt so egregiously in such inhumane and dauntingly violent ways that the concept, the prospect of trying to approach a reconciliation process seems like a betrayal of the reality of what they have done, of the harm that they have caused. But what Whit and I talked about in that episode is that the thing about forgiveness is 99% of the time, it's more about the person doing the forgiving than it is about the person being forgiven. It's more for the benefit of the person doing the forgiveness than it is for the benefit of the person being forgiven. And you definitely see that with these parents from this podcast, that like they decided to forgive this man, but they didn't necessarily have to make him a part of that process. They didn't reach out to him to say, hey, just so you know, we've forgiven you. We want you to be resting easy in prison and know that we've forgiven you. Their process was personal. It was just a personal decision that they were going to let him go, that they were going to let go of the way that they felt about him and not carry that with them anymore. And it was for them. It was for their own personal healing process. Him coming into their lives with the letter and them being open to a reconciliation process with him was a separate thing. That was sort of a separate deal. It, I think, added to and enriched the nature of the healing that they were experiencing through the process of forgiveness. It made it bolder and stronger, but the process and the decision to forgive him really wasn't for him at all. It was, you know, it didn't really have anything to do with him. And I think that that's a good way to think about it when you're dealing with something like carrying the weight and the burden of a years long grudge or a years long, you know, hatred for someone because of a harm or a wrong that they did to you, is that forgiving them, choosing to let that go, choosing to set that down will be far more beneficial for you. And it is for your benefit. And it is not necessarily for them, for the person that you are forgiving. Somebody just asked on TikTok, do you feel you actually understand forgiveness? I can't truly articulate it. It loses all meaning. That's an interesting question. I can give you my best shot at trying to articulate it. I'm not going to say that this is the definitive definition, but I would say that it is the process of consciously letting go of a held resentment. So it is the process of, and it's a process. It's not immediate. It's not, I make a decision one day to let go of my you know, abusive ex-partner and set that down and say, I'm going to let that, I'm making this decision that I am no longer holding that against them, that I no longer carry any anger or fear or sadness about that. I'm setting it down and letting that go. It's not that quick. It's a process. So I would say it's the process of setting down or letting go of a held resentment. And yeah, I really do truly believe that carrying resentment in your life and making the choice to consciously carry resentment is corrosive and adds to whatever trauma it is that you're hoping to heal from, and kind of always creates an impediment to full and deep and three-dimensional healing. I think that there can be a healing to a certain point while holding onto a resentment where you just say, you know what, I've made the choice to boldly live my life regardless of what that person did to me. I'm making the choice to continue stepping up and going after things that I want and making decisions for myself, and I'm not going to let the harm that that person caused me affect me. And you can still sort of like, you can almost like use your hatred of them and your anger for them as fuel, as rocket fuel to propel you forward through life. You can use that resentment to keep you moving forward in spite of them. And that can be a useful tool in that way. But I don't know that that's actually contributing to making the weight that you carry with you through your journey lighter, to making your experience in life lighter, to making your experience softer, and to making you be able to be open to love and enjoyment and joy more. Even though I don't think that it works as quickly as a simple decision, a decision that you make and then on a dime you switch and all of a sudden you've forgiven and you've reconciled and it's over, I do think that it does have to start with a choice. There does have to be a decision that you want to seek the process of reconciliation, that you want to begin the process of forgiveness. I think there does have to be some kind of conscious participation in that process on our part. And I'm going to tell a personal story now of mine from my life of a situation where I don't know if I will get reconciliation. And it's not really up to me, the decision of whether or not the reconciliation will happen or the forgiveness will be able to be possible is not really up to me. I know where my heart is, but I'm going to be speaking kind of vaguely. I won't be using names, but this is something I've been processing, and I haven't spoken about this publicly at all. People who are close to me know about this situation. My therapist knows about this situation. But a little over a couple of years ago, my very best friend in the world, who I'm closer with this person than I've, I have never really had a friendship that's as close as this one, at least in my mind. It's been a really weird couple of years because I'm sort of recontextualizing the way that I see this relationship, because I'm wondering if it was ever actually as profound and as deep of a connection as I thought it was or as I experienced it to be. But this is a person who, regularly throughout the years of our friendship would get upset at me for one reason or another, would have a resentment toward me, and would sort of kind of give me the silent treatment and stop talking to me for a while. And then I would approach them and say, why aren't you talking to me? What's going on? And then they would let me know the thing that they're mad at me about. And they'd, let me have it. And sometimes they would tell me, I don't think I can be your friend anymore. And I would always sort of talk them off the edge of the cliff and say, come on, we can work this out. We can be friends. And this happened so many times over the course of our long, long friendship. And this last time, this was a little over 2 years ago, I hadn't heard from them in a while on the phone or anything. That we don't live in the same state. And I'd been trying to reach out to them, and they weren't responding or answering. And I finally just sent a text message where I said, okay, I'm aware that you're not responding to me and that you're ignoring texts that I'm sending you and things like that. I would like to talk to you. Because I was not aware of anything that had happened. I wasn't aware of any friction. I wasn't aware that any faux pas had been made or that any harm had been done, but it was clear that something was wrong in the friendship. And so I just was like, whatever it is that's happened, whatever has occurred, I would love an opportunity to, somebody said, Sarah Leone says, to me, this sounds too romanticized. It's giving some toxic positivity. Just decide to let go of the resentment. Yeah, you know, Sarah, it doesn't sound like you're actually listening to what I'm saying, because I was very, very clear. I did a whole section in the podcast about how I'm not saying you just decide and then it's over. I said it's a process that takes a long time. I was very, very specific about that, that it doesn't happen overnight, that it's not easy. And I've also been very, very clear several times in this podcast about how I completely understand and have empathy for people who are struggling with finding the strength or the desire to approach a reconciliation or a forgiveness process. So I'm definitely not just saying, just decide to be happy or just decide to let go of it and it'll fix all your problems. I am saying that I believe that in order to have a successful reconciliation in your life or a successful forgiveness process, it will require a conscious decision at some point to begin that process. But I'm not saying that it's easy, and I'm not saying that it happens quickly. It usually takes a lot of time, and it's usually very difficult and requires a lot of effort. So yeah, I'm not sure how that you were listening properly if that's the message that you got. But anyway, going back to this story with my friend, he finally called me one day. I answer the phone and he goes, so do you want to get into it? And I said, yeah, I would love to hear. I'd love to hear what's going on. And I sat on the phone while he probably for about 15 to 20 minutes listed off a list a mile long of wrongs that I had done and harms that I had done going back about 10 years. It was a very long list of things that had piled up over years, little things that I had said that were perceived slights, or things that I had done that he felt left out of, or ways that I had acted that made him feel overlooked or undervalued. And many of them were things that we had talked about when they happened. So it was like things that it was like, yeah, I do remember that. That's a thing we had talked about. But you know, in the past, when we had gotten into these conversations, I did a lot of like interrupting him and defending myself and trying to explain what that actually was. But this time, and I think it's because of therapy, and I think it's because of my years in recovery, I just had this feeling, just let him talk and let him speak until he's finished. And in my memory, it took probably 15 to 20 minutes for him to get through the list of all of the things that I had done. And he finished, and I really decided I'm not going to try to devalue what he's telling me in any way, or say, yeah, but what about this, or anything like that. And I just said, hey, I hear you. I did do all of those things. I remember us talking about many of them at the time that they happened, but it sounds like you still have a lot of feelings about them. And those things are true. Like, I have not been a perfect friend, and I have let you down in those ways, and I have failed to show up for you as a friend in those ways. And I really did my best to just take it and own it and say, I hear it. And then say, and then I said to him, you know, this relationship is one of the most singularly important relationships of my life. What can I do to make amends to you and to show you that how much I value this relationship and to repair this relationship? And his response to me was, I don't want you to fix it. I just don't want to be your friend anymore. And I want you to respect that. And again, like I said, in the past, I would have fought him on that and said, like, no, you don't just get to like ditch me. I'm your best friend. Like, no, we got to fix this. But he was asking for something very clear. He was setting a very clear boundary. And I just said, okay, I love you very much, and I will miss you dearly. And, you know, I'm always here if you ever want to talk. And that was it. And we have not spoken in over 2 years. And the reason I bring this story up is, in talking about the process of reconciliation and in talking about what carrying resentment and holding a grudge does, I don't know, this came up in my mind too as I was approaching thinking about this topic for the podcast, because, you know, this friend of mine got married recently, and I obviously wasn't invited to the wedding, and that's okay. You know, that's all right. But I there's just so many things that have been happening in his life that I just feel he's still such an important person to me. And I had a couple friends and even like my therapist that was like, I think it's okay if you want to send him a letter just saying congratulations, and just, you don't need to say anything that you're trying to like understand or trying like that you're questioning like his position on things or anything like that. You can just let him know that you're happy for him and thinking about him and congratulations. And I had a lot of people in my life say, I think that would be a nice thing to do. And I thought, you know what? I will. And it's sort of like this letter that this man wrote from prison. You know, he kind of said, I went back and forth for the longest time on whether or not I wanted to write you guys that letter, because I really didn't feel comfortable like violating your privacy that way, or like, you know, entering your space in that way, like without you necessarily agreeing to me entering your space in that way. And that's sort of how I felt about reaching out to my friend. It took me a while. It took me several months. I wrote several drafts of the letter, and I sent the letter to my sponsor, and I had him read it over, and I said, does this sound okay? Does this sound like I'm being emotionally manipulative, or does this sound clear? And I sent it to several friends and, you know, got feedback on it before I sent it. And then I bought a book that I thought he would like, and I wrote the letter on the inside jacket of the book, and I sent him the book. And, you know, my hope was that whether I ever heard from him or not, that it could be received in a spirit of like, you know what? I still don't want to be friends with that guy, but like, this is a nice gesture, and I see that. But also, like, that's not the part of the work that's mine. That's not the part of the situation that I own. I don't get to control his process or his feelings. You know, but I think I did have this selfish desire that my gesture would be received in the spirit that it was offered, which was just to say, I still love you very much, and I will probably continue to love you very much for the rest of my life, and you're still just a massively important person to me who's added a lot of value to my life. And what I heard was, so the mutual friend of ours who gave me his address and allowed me to send this letter called me up and said, yeah, he called me on the phone and was really mad at me and said, did you give him my address? And I said, yeah. And he said, I really wish you wouldn't have done that. I didn't want to hear from him. You know, and that's what I heard was his response to that. And that's very, you know, like he gets that, like he doesn't owe me anything. He gets to have that response. And, you know, the parents of this guy that murdered their child, they get to, if they wanted to, they could have said, how dare you send us this letter? How dare you send us how dare you think that we would want to hear from you? How gross of you to violate our healing process like this. But because they had made the decision in their own personal lives to set that resentment down before the letter arrived, because they had been engaged in that process of working on setting down that resentment, she describes it in the podcast as slowly unpacking a backpack full of rocks that she'd been carrying around for years. I mean, this was like 18 years after her son died that she finally decided to set this thing down. I mean, it takes time. So I really have to reiterate that I'm not saying it's this simple light switch thing that you just decide to forgive and forgiveness is achieved. It's a process and it's difficult, but the letter that was sent would not have been received, and the process of reconciliation that ensued would not have been possible if they had not made that decision for themselves to do the work of setting down that resentment and letting go of it. So what was, you know, the information that I got from that was that this friend, up until at this point in our lives, has not yet made the decision that he wants to set that down. And that's okay. I truly don't believe that I've done anything to this person that is irreconcilable. I don't believe that I've done anything that is certainly not on the level of murdering one of his family members. You know, it really wasn't, I'm not going to go into the details of it because they're private between the two of us, but I will tell you this, that like, I have never been a perfect friend to anyone in my life, and I have done harms to people I care about many, many times in my life. But it wasn't, there wasn't anything in there that was like, I stole money from this person, or I sold this person out to, you know, somebody. I got this person fired from their job. I broke up this person's last relationship by cheating on their partner, cheated on them with me. Like, there was nothing like that. There was no grand betrayal or like massive trauma inflicted. It was just sort of like several annoyances, like just little things, little behaviors of mine over the years that had built up for this person that made them just decide, I don't like that guy anymore. And that's valid. That's okay. You can decide not to like a person, but this is the sort of third act of this story. And this is what I wanted to talk about, is like the observation of what I think it does to carry that kind of resentment around in your life, and what kind of experience it creates. And again, I really want to make it clear, I am saying this without judgment. I'm saying this understanding that, like, I'm a person who deals with resentment and who carries around anger and resentment frequently, and I understand what that's like. But recently, I saw on social media this person posted something about a new job that they had. And they had written a bio for that job. They had a self-written bio about their life currently and where they're at. And I read it. And, you know, you could maybe think that maybe this is an invasion of this person's privacy and maybe I shouldn't be reading their social media posts if they want me out of their life. And there might be something valid to be said there. Possibly, yeah. But I'm not imposing. I'm not commenting on anything. I'm not, like, sending him messages or, you know, like, I very much am out of the picture. But I just sort of check in from time to time because I care about him and I just want to make sure he's doing okay. But I checked in on this thing, and there was a sentence at the end of this bio that he wrote for himself where he said he likes two things in this world, his dog and music. And I got to tell you, that sentence kind of broke my heart. By the way, he's married. Like, he has a wife. And he wrote the sentence in his bio, he likes two things in this world, his dog and music. And it also hurt. It broke my heart to hear that he was upset about my letter and my book and my gift that I sent him for his wedding. Not because it broke my heart that he's still mad at me. It broke my heart to know that he's living his life, moving through life with that anger and with that resentment that to me is pretty unnecessary. You know, carrying resentment from like a massive trauma that someone's caused you, I think that's understandable and carrying that for years, but to just be carrying a resentment that I don't actually think is necessary for him to carry or for him to hold, and to see the way that it has transformed his experience of the world, and to see that, like, he just seems like he's just kind of mad all the time and like he doesn't really enjoy much. And he self-describes himself as a person who only likes two things in the world. And I think that that's sort of the result of living with anger and hatred and resentment, is that it sort of hardens and coarsens your experience with everything. And it sort of diminishes your ability to experience and appreciate joy. And I don't know. And again, I really want to say I'm offering this without judgment and in the least sanctimonious way possible. Like, I am a person who struggles with resentment. My problem is I resent people I don't know all the time. I just am, like, totally happy to walk around the rest of my life hating Donald Trump and Mitch McConnell and Tucker Carlson and, you know, like, and I just am like, I'm just going to hate them. But it seems like it doesn't really, like, affect me because I don't actually, like, I don't really have any attachment to them in any significant, serious way. It seems kind of immaterial, but it's still heavy. That resentment, that anger, that hatred is still heavy. And it still does take away from my ability to experience joy. And so, I don't know, I've just been thinking about that. I've been thinking about the fact that, like, people go through reconciliation processes that are miraculous all the time. Every single day, people overcome a ravine of trauma and pain and hurt through a reconciliation and a forgiveness process that is like, that seems impossible. And it's really so amazing whenever it happens and so beautiful. It's one of the most beautiful things that humans do. And if it were easy to do, we'd be doing it a lot more often. If it were easy, then it'd be easy, but it's not easy. It's hard. And so again, I understand, and I am going to allow this person all the time he needs to make a decision that he wants to set that resentment down and see if he can embrace more joy in his life. And maybe he won't ever. And that has nothing to do with me. I don't really get to decide that. But the third sort of space I wanted to talk about in this podcast, in this topic, I've talked about this thing, the letter, the story that really moved me. I've talked about my personal story. But the other thing that I've been thinking about a lot is where we are in our socio-political discourse. And this is a thing that I talk about a lot on this podcast, is where we are in the geopolitical and socio-political discourse. What's happening? How are we talking to each other? What are the issues? How are we relating to each other? How are we problem solving? And right now, there is a particular particular appeal to a form of full-throated absolutism where it's all or nothing, where your advocacy, your allyship, your stance is all or nothing. You are either entirely with a position and you fully agree with every single tenet of that position, or you are a mortal enemy of that position and, you know, you are like at war with that position. And it's something that I think is really alarming to me. A friend of mine who does what I do, who makes videos commenting on the socio-political space, sent me a video recently asking me to share it and boost it. This is something that a lot of my content creator friends do from time to time. They'll send me a video and say, hey, this video is getting, you know, bogged down by the algorithm. Will you boost it and promote it, please? And this was a video that he made about the genocide in Gaza. And I watched the video, and it's like a 7.5 minute long video. And I agree with every single word that he says in the video. And he's basically outlining, you know, just all of the atrocities and the level of them, the magnitude of them, and the death count, and the killing of children, the bombing of hospitals, and the constant shepherding, you know, herding people into safe zones and then bombing the hell out of those safe zones. For our podcast listeners who are just listening, I am doing big air quotes when I say safe zones, because what is happening is undeniably a global humanitarian crisis that demands our attention and our compassion and respect and our advocacy and our allyship. And he's saying all this and he's advocating for all these things, and I'm fully agreeing with him and I'm nodding my head through the entire video. And then we get to like the final stretch, the final minute of the video, where he explains that if you're with him, if you stand with him, if you agree with him, your allyship has to be all or nothing. And the way that he sort of describes this and frames this is that you cannot simultaneously hold the idea that we need to be calling out what's happening in Gaza and condemning and decrying this humanitarian crisis, and also have an eye on trying to keep right-wing authoritarian extremism, religious extremism, from the executive branch in November. And that's a space that a lot of people on the left are occupying right now, is like, how do I have one foot in the camp of criticizing the Biden-Harris administration for their support and their role in this ongoing ethnic cleansing and genocide, and also have an eye on trying to prevent right-wing religious extremists from the executive branch of power? How do I square those two things? And what this person was saying at the end of this video is, you don't square those two things. And if you try to, and he's very clear about this, he says, if you try to, in my opinion, you can fuck off and die. And he's very clear about that. He just says, fuck off and die, and I don't care. That's how I actually feel about you. And he doubled down on it in a video that he posted a couple days later, saying, I already told you how I feel about you. If you don't agree with me on this, fuck off and die. Essentially just saying, I genuinely don't care if you're dead if you think that you can try to navigate these two positions. And that's sort of where we're at right now in the sociopolitical discourse, is that it's like, we can be completely agreeing and saying the same thing, and then if we come to a point in the road where we have a difference of opinion on tactics of how to show our advocacy adequately or how to maneuver in the political landscape right now and what the best moves are and what the most useful moves are, if we have a disagreement there, it's fully fuck you. I don't care if you die. You are now my enemy. And it's scorched earth. It's just instant. I want nothing to do with you. And that to me is a really, really difficult place to work from, because there's so many people that are going scorched earth with me, particularly lately, with some of the content that I post and some of the messages that I try to advocate for on the podcast and on my YouTube channel. There's a lot of people that used to be followers of mine, that are friends of mine, close friends of mine, who are going scorched earth with me right now over this issue. And I want so badly to be able to have a dialogue with them and to be able to see if we can hear each other. And they're letting me know from the outset that that is not something they are remotely interested in. They're telling me immediately, no, listen to what I'm saying. I'm saying, fuck you. I'm saying, go away and die. Fuck you. I hate you. I genuinely despise you because we're having a disagreement on the approach, you know, the like how do what's the best way to try to deal with the many various horrors ongoing in the world, you know? We agree about the severity and the nature of the problem. We agree on that, but then when we talk about what's the most realistic, what's the most useful, what's the best, most pragmatic way to approach this, if we have a disagreement there, it's not just, well, we have a disagreement on that, but I still, you know, I get where you're coming from, and best of luck to you and your approach, and I'll see where we can meet up on other things. It's, no, you're either all in on this with me, or 100% with every single aspect of what I'm saying, or you are my mortal enemy, and I want nothing to do with you, and I don't even want to have a dialogue. I don't even want to have the possibility of hearing you out. I don't even want to entertain the possibility that you might have something potentially worthwhile, worth listening to. And that to me is like, that sort of, I wanted to see if I could shoehorn that into this discussion of reconciliation and forgiveness, because what I really keep feeling is missing right now, and how we're missing each other and how we're not hearing each other, is we are not honoring each other's humanity. I really am trying my best to honor the emotional experience that the people who are going scorched earth with me are having, and to respect the fact that, like, I do respect where they're coming from, that I understand the internal moral logic of their reaction, of their emotional response. I see it and I go, no, that makes sense to me. I get it. I get how you arrive at that place, and I am sympathetic and compassionate for it. I'm really trying to, like, see and get inside of that human experience and honor that humanity. And what's difficult is feeling like the people that I'm trying to engage with in that space have no interest in extending that same process. They're like, I'm not interested in trying to get inside of how you arrived at the conclusion you arrived at. I'm not interested in trying to get it. You know, I mean, I've talked about this on this podcast before, and I've talked about it in a YouTube video too, a couple YouTube videos, that like, I even get pushback from these people if I try to open up the possibility of holding space for Jewish friends who have family in Israel who have been like affected, who they're trying to, like, you know, hold space for their family members and stuff, and have compassion and sympathy and empathy for their family members. And I'm like, can we do that? And people are like, absolutely not. Absolutely not. If you have any sympathy, any compassion for those colonizer white supremacist Zionists, then you're a fascist piece of shit. And I'm like, well, can it be? Can there be a space where I can see the human experience of a person who I go, hey, you're on the team that I disagree with here, or the country that you live in represents the team that I think is more in the wrong here, demonstrably more in the wrong here, and I can still say there are people having a human experience in there that I can like see and try to find compassion for. And just that concept, like just the idea of trying to open up that space and hold that space for a lot of people who are the all or nothing advocates is, that's a non-starter right there. I've gotten close to having a dialogue with a couple people, and what I've heard from them is, well, it sounds like you're prioritizing Jewish fear and Jewish pain right now instead of prioritizing Arab pain and Arab fear. And I see that. What if I make it really, really clear that that's not what I'm doing? That like the vast majority of my posts, the vast majority of my messaging is making sure that I'm being very demonstrable and clear that what is happening is a genocide, is an ethnic cleansing, is a humanitarian crisis, is something that requires pressure and action from the international political community and governmental community. What if I make that really clear and then still say, and I also have friends who I want to hold space for their pain as well over here in this area. Can I do that so that it's clear that I'm not giving priority to one or the other? And it doesn't seem like they're open to even that. And then I get into the space of being like, doesn't that feel kind of anti-Semitic? I don't know. Like that it's like, you're not even willing to like, to even be open to the possibility of someone just like having space for like Jewish pain and like that. I don't know. Like that does wind up sounding kind of anti-Jewish to me. Like me just trying to find humanity there is like a step too far. That's me like crossing the line and becoming the enemy. And I don't know. Like, it starts to sound really quickly that I'm like, I know that you're saying that your stance against Zionism and colonialism has nothing to do with anti-Semitism, and I believe you. But then when I introduce the concept, the idea, the possibility of holding space for multiple truths about how you can have compassion and empathy in a situation like this, you're off the map with rage about that idea, and you're completely scorched earth and closed off to the possibility of a dialogue continuing. And that to me doesn't seem congruous with my, you know, this ideology is not anti-Semitic. It's just in support of people who are being brutalized by a power far greater than themselves. I guess what I'm saying here is like, the reconciliation process is one of my favorite things that humans are capable of. Forgiveness and a willingness to be open to recognizing humanity in each other and fallibility in each other is something that I think is so beautiful. And it is a process and it is difficult. And resentment is really, really enticing and really, really hard to let go of. And it can act as a fuel and act as a propellant. But I think right now, if we're going to find a way forward, we're going to have to find a better way of talking to each other and of trying to find each other's humanity. And that's all from me. Let's see what the comments are talking about right now. Let's see how mad people are at me for what I'm saying. Zen Samich over on YouTube says, the paradox of tolerance. The only thing we cannot tolerate is intolerance. So if people don't want to listen to the other, they suck whether they are left or right. Okay, I see what you're saying there. This is something that, you know, the right will often criticize the left and go like, oh, the tolerant left, you know, the myth of the tolerant left. But you guys aren't tolerant of us. You're not tolerant of our religious beliefs and our religious convictions. And you're not tolerant of our positions on gender ideology and things like that. And it's like, well, that's because your positions and your beliefs are steeped in bigotry and intolerance. So being a tolerant person and being a person who seeks for the humanity in others does not require you necessarily to be tolerant of other people's intolerance. So even being a forgiving person or a person who's willing to let go of resentment doesn't mean that you have to be okay with whatever harm it was that they caused. That family being willing to forgive that man in prison doesn't mean that they are saying that what he did is okay. In no way, shape, or form does it mean that they are absolving him of that behavior or saying that it's okay. What they're saying is we are choosing to set that down. We're choosing to set the anger that we carry down and to try to see you as the man that you are now, the human that exists beyond that action. And I can do that for a lot of conservatives and conservative friends. I can be willing to set aside my feelings for their intolerant beliefs and bigoted behaviors and see the human beyond that. And I have friends and family members who I disagree with massively on huge things. I think they have disgusting beliefs on certain things, but I'm still willing to recognize that there is a fully three-dimensional human behind that belief with a human experience that's worth trying to understand in some way. Eric Mahler on YouTube says, all or nothing is a great way to make zero progress. I kind of agree just because of how massively pluralistic the world is. I just don't think in a world this ideologically pluralistic, anyone can realistically think that all or nothing is a workable philosophy. I was talking about this before I started recording, but one of the major problems that the Democratic Party has is that they are a big tent party, and I don't think people understand what that means. They hear that phrase from political pundits, and they hear people saying things like that, big tent. It's basically just this, like, the Republican Party has to cater their message and their policies toward a much more culturally and ideologically homogenous demographic than the Democratic Party does. The Republican Party is primarily just the vast majority of people that they have to cater to are white Christian people, overwhelmingly. And so the messaging that they have to come out with and the policies that they have to come out with in support of don't have to be as broad and don't have to appeal to as broad of a base of as many differing ideas and viewpoints. Whereas the Democratic Party, representing the left of the political spectrum in America, has to appeal to a much wider net of a plurality of ideological viewpoints and cultural viewpoints. There are just so many more religious viewpoints, cultural viewpoints, ideological touch points, and perspectives and backgrounds represented by the left than there are by the right. And it makes it a lot harder to craft policy that will be liked by and supported by all of those people. And so to have any position anywhere in the world on any issue that's you're either with me all or you're entirely against me, and that's the only thing that I will accept is all or nothing, in a world that is this ideologically pluralistic, I think is really, really short-sighted. I don't think it's very realistic. I don't think that it's actually dealing with the world as it actually is. Let's see here. My mom says, I'm his mom, and I love those dimples. Great. Thank you, Mom. Jacob Hawkins says, can we talk about Argyle? We talked about it briefly at the beginning of the episode. I think it's one of the worst movies ever made. I just made an hour-long YouTube video about it that you can go watch. It's great. It's really fun. It's definitely going to have a lot more jokes in it than this podcast has so far. This podcast has been pretty serious so far. Haley D on YouTube says, I'm trans. I can't set down my hurt for the Republicans in my state trying to pass laws against me. The Iowa governor is trying to make me carry special papers so everyone can identify me as trans. Not me saying you are all telling me to do that. It's hard to see any humanity in those who deny mine. And I mean, yeah, Haley, yes, yes. You are, if you need validation from somebody, you got it from me. And I also share your position. I carry actively resentment for those exact same policies and those exact same beliefs. It is very hard for me not to resent people who can't reckon with the plain reality that trans people exist. It's very like baffling to me and just sort of mentally discombobulating to me that people cannot just deal with the very plain observable reality that there are people in our society who are telling us that they are having an experience with gender that shatters the notion of a gender binary. And they have been here telling us this for a very long, for all of human history. And the fact that that's just always been a thing and that people just cannot come to the table on that and just reconcile with that is a really hard thing for me to not have resentment about. I have a video coming out tomorrow where I talk about that, where I talk about the fact that, like, you know, conservative gender ideology usually plays into the idea, or they talk about how, like, progressive gender ideology is a woke mind virus. We're all mentally ill. We're all, you know, we're not seeing reality as it is. We're calling men women and women men, and we're crazy. But actually, like, so often, conservatives will just be, like, all up in the comments of trans people just existing, just out in the world existing, just living their lives. And conservative people will just be all up in their comments being like, you're a man or you're a woman. And that person is, like, so plainly identifiable as not a man or not a woman. And it's like, it's actually weirder to, it's more of a mental walk to look at a person who is very clearly identifiable as a woman and be like, that's a man. And, like, insist, you know, like, that takes, like, you have to, like, stop your brain from instantly categorizing that person as a woman and make the conscious choice to recategorize them as a man once you learn that they're trans. And that means that, like, to me, I'm like, you're doing the bigger mental gymnastics there. So, yeah, Haley, I completely empathize with your position and also agree with it. And that's why I'm saying over and over and over again in this podcast that letting go of resentment, setting it down, trying to recognize the humanity in your enemies and in the people who are ideologically opposed to you, or even in just people who have done you great harms and caused you great pain, is no easy feat. It's monumentally difficult. And I think that's what makes it so beautiful. I think that, like, I think we are moved by difficult feats. I think the reason why people like watching sports, not everyone likes watching sports, but some people do, and they are massively popular worldwide. And I think one of the reasons that they are is we like seeing incredible feats. We like seeing a last second shot. Like, we, Caitlin Clark tonight, dude, just became the NCAA women's basketball scoring champion of all time. Highest scoring women's basketball player, college basketball player of all time in a 49-point game. And watching her do it, watching her, knowing that she's going into that game with the entire world watching her, knowing that she could break the all-time scoring record that game, and knowing that she's got that pressure on her back, and just watching her drain logo threes and score 49 points is a feat. It's not easy what she's doing. It's like superhuman what she's doing. And that's why we like watching it. That's why we're impressed by it. That's why we're moved by it. The reason why we're moved by incredible singing is because it feels like a person is doing something with their voice that feels like a superpower. Like they're using the power of their voice to reach into your soul. And it's hard work, and it's difficult, and it's a honed skill, and we are moved by it. And I think we are moved by forgiveness and reconciliation because it's some of the hardest work we can do. So I really can't stress enough that the message of this podcast is not just forgive people, it's really easy. It's the opposite. It's forgiveness is immensely powerful and beautiful, and it's also incredibly hard. Born to Bark says, the left is not a monolith. So many different views and some nutty with extreme. The right marches in step. And, you know, in general, that's correct. The right obviously has diversity of thought in their ranks. It's just nowhere near the diversity of thought that exists on the left. And it's so much less that it's almost like it statistically doesn't exist, and it's almost like they all march in lockstep. Someone said, how does this affect LeBron's legacy? Caitlin Clark, how does Caitlin Clark affect LeBron's legacy? I don't know, but I want to have my friend on here who's a professional female hooper, and I've been wanting to have her on the podcast for a while to just talk about, like, women's sports and just talk about, like, I don't know. I've been watching a lot of women's hoops this year. My Utah Utes, the Lady Utes, have been pretty good, and I've been watching a lot of their games, and I've been watching a lot of, like, Caitlin Clark's games. I haven't seen an athlete as entertaining as Caitlin Clark in a long time. I just like watching greatness. I mean, I was one of those unpopular people who actually enjoyed watching Pat Mahomes win the Super Bowl back-to-back just because I like watching greatness. I like watching someone be like, you don't think I can do that? Watch me. You know, like I like Christian McCaffrey, and I probably would have been fine with either of those teams winning. But to have Pat Mahomes be like, yeah, it's Pat Mahomes in the Super Bowl in overtime. Watch this, you know, and it's like, that's awesome that all eyes on him, whole world watching, all the pressure in the world. And he's like, got it. You know, it's incredible. I don't know. I love watching LeBron. Dude's almost 40 years old, and he still just wows me all the time. He's always doing things that I think are incredible. Let's do a couple more comments, and then we'll wrap it up, because this one's been going on long enough. let's see here. Randy says, hey, our society has taught us what woman and man is supposed to be. Okay, Randy. That's so funny. Because again, this is a good point. I'm actually glad that Randy said this, because this goes back to what I was saying earlier. Is like, you have to be more detached from objective reality to think that society has clearly shown that that gender exists on a fixed, rigid binary. You have to be actively not paying attention to what society is actually telling us and what society actually looks like to think that way. I think about this all the time. I'm just like, I'm out in public all the time, and I'll just like see a person who was probably assigned female at birth, who presents in a very comfortably masculine way, who probably still identifies as a woman, like a person who, like, I don't know what their gender is, but it's a person who's like out in the world, just like shopping at the grocery store, who probably identifies as a woman, who's wearing like baggy shorts and like an oversized shirt, has a short haircut, and like, you know, like is dressed in a very like traditionally masculine way. And I just think to myself, like, I see people like this all the time, everywhere, all the time. I see a person who was probably assigned male at birth, who's out in public, who maybe still identifies as a man, or maybe is non-binary, and is just like presenting comfortably in a way that very clearly shows everyone around them, I am not adhering to this rigid gender binary because it is not comfortable for me, and it does not express who I am adequately. And that's what society is teaching us about gender. So when Ray says society has taught us what a man and a woman is, I'm like, yeah, you're right, Ray, but not in the way that you think. Society has shown us very clearly, and has been showing us throughout all time, what gender is and how gender works and how it functions. And like, to the point where, like, you know, conservatives will say stuff like, well, you guys can't even answer the question, what is a woman? And I kind of think that, like, my new answer to that question is like, you know a woman when you see one. You know, it's sort of like when people say, like, I don't know how to define pornography, but I know it when I see it. That old thing that whoever that politician was that said that. I'm like, I sort of feel that way too about a woman. I'm just like, you know what a woman is. Like, when someone approaches you and you see that they're clearly a woman, you can tell. You know, and that's not to say that trans people have to pass or be visibly like coded as one gender or the other in order for their identity to be valid or in order to earn your respect. But it's like, you know, like if you are actually existing in reality and observing society as it is plainly presented to you, you are observing gender diversity everywhere you go, and gender diverse people and gender nonconforming people everywhere you go. So to pretend that all you see in society is this rigid binary of this is a woman and this is a man you have to really ignore a lot of society to pretend that that's the reality that you live in. Sean Harcourt on TikTok said, "There's no paradox in intolerance, though. Willfully evil intolerance is unforgivable." Again, I want to make it really, really clear. I understand how people come by this position. I understand being hurt so deeply and experiencing such great trauma that you feel like there are certain things, certain behaviors that are beyond the realm of possible forgiveness. I'm going to respectfully disagree. I personally, and this is just a choice, literally. It's just a thing that I'm choosing. I just want to believe that there is nothing beyond the realm of forgiveness. Again, because I also believe that forgiveness has more to do with the person doing the forgiving than it does with the person being forgiven. So if I want to make the decision to forgive someone for being willfully ignorant, even though they're not going to stop being willfully ignorant or they're going to continue whatever the bad behavior is, I have the option to make that choice for myself. I have the option to engage with that process. Again, not saying that it's an easy process, not saying that it's a process that is that it's a thing that's achieved simply, but I do have that option. Randy's back. Oh, cool. Randy said one of my favorite lines ever. I love when people say this. Randy said, "Sexuality is crammed down our throats." Randy's got the script. He's got the, he knows what to say. He knows all the lines. "Sexuality is crammed down our throats." They love that. Man, my whole life, conservatives have been talking about people cramming things down their throats. It's so funny. And it's also really funny because, like, nobody crams their worldview and their ideas down everyone else's throats more than conservatives. Conservatives are so hell-bent on making sure that the rest of the world has to live according to their personal beliefs. Like Randy here is like so determined that everyone agree with him on what good and unsinful sexuality is and what healthy expression of gender is, that he refuses to accept that queer people exist. Like, he refuses to accept that millions of people are real. And he sees their existence as evidence of sexuality being crammed down his throat. He has to dissociate from reality in order to achieve the beliefs that he has. Like, that's, yeah, it's wild stuff. yeah. Anyway, somebody asked, who asked this? Somebody. Oh, Joey, the queer Satanist. Hello, Joey, the queer Satanist. Said, "Austin, more music when?" What a good question. I actually, like, sooner than you think. Not as soon as I would want, but, like, soon. I've got a single that I want to come out with sometime in the next 6 months. Let's say sometime in the next 6 months, I have a single that I would really like to come out with. I have a new TikTok song that I think I can come out with probably in the next month. I think it can happen. And then I have this collection of songs that I'm writing with a friend, that if we're using these songs to pitch ourselves to a record label to fund a record for us. And if we get that funded, then that would be a whole new record sometime in, like, the next year. But at least there will be, like, one or two new singles this year. So thank you for asking about that. And thank you for being aware that the music exists. I really appreciate that. Yeah, I think we can wrap it up there, right? My mom says, we'll leave it here. Julie says, "Can't we just love everyone unconditionally?" In all caps, she writes. And she writes, question mark, exclamation point, question mark, exclamation point, question mark. And yeah, Jules. Yeah. I'll even say this. I love you, Randy. Thank you for being here. And thank you for providing the other side of the conversation. And thank you for giving me something to talk about and giving me a way to sort of bounce the examples of how I'm trying to bounce what I'm talking about against, you know, and point out how it works in real life. But yeah, I think that we can strive for unconditional love, and we can strive to be open to reconciliation and forgiveness and that process, knowing that it's a very hard thing to do. That's all. Thanks for being here, everybody. Thank you for your comments. What a lovely discussion on this episode. I think this went really well, and I think I feel really good about it. People Pleaser is written, edited, hosted, and produced by me, Austin Archer, with original theme music also by me. You can find more of my music by looking up Austin Archer on Spotify or Apple Music. You can look me up on YouTube and check out my YouTube videos or watch my music videos on there. You can go to austinarchermusic.bandcamp.com and get my vinyl, my double vinyl, dude. If you don't got that double vinyl, if you're not rocking that Austin Archer Beautiful Things, the deluxe edition double vinyl, what are you doing with your life? Go get the double vinyl. You will love it. I will be so excited to package it up and send it to you. It'll be a lot of fun. Patreon.com/Austin Archer. My Patreon patrons are hanging in tough, dude. They're hanging in there. We got some real strong people who are hanging in there, and I love them for it. Would love to have you if you have the available means to support what I do that way. Patreon.com/Austin Archer. All right. You know what? That's it. That's the show. We'll see you again next week or some other time. Take care of yourselves. Take care of each other. Be good. Be kind. Love you so much. Bye-bye. Eventually.